Who knew a dodgeball game between Robert De Niro, Christopher Walken, Cheech Marin, Jane Seymour, and a bunch of rowdy kids could be so bland? That's from Johnny Oleksinski of the New York Post. The review of The War with Grandpa. That's right. Saw it in theaters. First movie my kids have seen in 7 months in a movie theater. And I'm pretty sure it's the first movie they've ever seen starring one of my favorite actors, Robert De Niro. We'll talk about The War with Grandpa and why I disagree with the critics. Yeah, take that. All these critics crapping all over it. You know what? It's a good family film. Also, The Good Lord Bird, season one review. One of my favorite actors, Ethan Hawke. He has a tremendous show right now on Showtime. It's a limited series. Ethan Hawke is bringing the heat. And I finally saw, I'd never seen it. Listen, we all have oversights, right? Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, Charlie Kaufman film, which he wrote, which he disavowed, said he has no love for it because he says that nothing is actually like it. Like it, nothing of what he wrote is like the actual film. So that's why he's kind of disavowed it. George Clooney, of course, directorial debut. And the reason I really wanted to watch it was the big reason is it really kind of announced Sam Rockwell as a leading man and a guy to be reckoned with. So I finally got around to watching Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. Once again, thank you as always for checking out Cinephile. Please go to Apple Podcasts and you can subscribe, rate, and review. Appreciate all the support that everyone is giving us. And as I check out some of the reviews here on Apple Podcasts, oh, that's right. We were supposed to do that for Mount Rushmore. All right, we'll do that Mount Rushmore next week. People are talking about the Mount Rushmore directors because somebody had thrown it out there. And so, you know what? We'll do it next week. Somebody was mentioning here Spielberg, Zemeckis, Scorsese, Burton. That's from Jason Parolo. Thank you, Jason, for the review. I promise we will do it next time. From Docklew, Iowa, and I was talking about guests just coming to dinner. Tracy was dying, so they filmed his last speech first. The metaphor of the movie is at the ice cream shop. He does not get what he wanted, but likes it nonetheless. Tracy died soon after, seeing this movie many times. When Kate is crying during his speech, those tears are real, knowing he was dying. That's amazing. I did not know. I know it was Spencer Tracy's final film appearance. I did not realize he was dying during the filming. That's amazing. Good stuff there from Docklew, Iowa. The Bad Guy 187, always supporting us. And meh. Was not a fan at first, but found I was missing it while he was gone. I think Rags brings some pretty good stuff, but what I like is how Adnan reacts to him. It's like they're old buddies. Glad to have him back. That's right. Rags is back, by the way. Rags time. He's kind of all over the place. He hasn't been sleeping a whole lot, so get ready for Rags time. He's back. And Tug Coker, big news. He's a great guy. Great guest. Follow him on Twitter and Instagram, at Tug Coker. Now We're Talking is his show. It's really funny. A couple of ex-NFL quarterbacks trying to find work now in the sports media world. Obviously something I know a little bit about. CW Seed is where you can find the show. Seasons 1, Seasons 2. Seasons 1 was in Quick Bite. Season 2 is a little more long form. It's absolutely tremendous, and make sure that you check it out. We're going to talk to Tug momentarily. It's coming out. First, let's do some reviews. The War with Grandpa. That's right. Peter and his grandpa used to be very close. When Grandpa Jack moves in with the family, Peter is forced to give up his most prized possession, his bedroom. Peter will stop at nothing to get his room back, scheming with friends to devise a series of pranks to drive him out. However, Grandpa doesn't give up easily, and it turns into an all-out war between the two. Listen, this is what we used to call in the business, well, they still call it the business, a high-concept film. High-concept film normally means it's like, you know, a Spielberg film or like a Michael Bay movie. You know what I mean? It's Die Hard on a plane. You know? That's the hook for a Con Air, whatever it is. That's the true high-concept. But I'm using high-concept in a different term here. High-concept in that it's not a high concept. It's a fairly simple concept. It's one note. That's probably the better expression for it. It's one note. But I think if you play that note successfully, it works. The note is this. Grandpa's moving in. The kid doesn't want him there. They start fighting back and forth about the fact he wants to be in his room. And Grandpa's taken over his room. So that's kind of the way this thing goes. But I think what's honestly enjoyable about this film and why I like this movie, despite the skewering it is taking on Rotten Tomatoes, is you have familiar faces in comfortable roles, giving you what you're looking for, okay? We're back in a movie theater at AMC. I'm so pumped to be back at the mall in Paramus, New Jersey. $38 for tickets on a Saturday afternoon. Me and three of my boys, very fired up. We got a large popcorn, $9, a couple of slushies, $5. I'm thrilled to pay those prices, by the way. You can charge double. I'm just so glad to be back at the movies. Masks on the whole time, unless you're eating or drinking, totally fine. A little disappointed the no refill on the large popcorn. Normally that's a nice little caveat. But because of COVID-19, being smart, hey, no refills of anything, no problem, totally get it. So you know what? I'm in a comfortable place. I'm watching one of my favorite actors, Robert De Niro, a familiar face on the screen, and I see him with some familiar actors. I haven't seen him in a while, especially Uma Thurman. Uma Thurman playing his daughter in the movie. She's the one convincing Grandpa he's got to stay at home. He can't be by himself after her mom, his wife, has passed away. Rob Riggle. Good role for Rob. Gets to play, being a Robert De Niro film, playing Uma Thurman's husband. Less mugging than we normally expect from Rob. Sometimes I think he overacts a little too much, but I thought he was more subdued, at least by Riggle-esque standards. Laura Morano, fantastic. She's the daughter. And then Cheech Marin. he's one of the buddies there that De Niro has as he's kind of, you know, meeting some old friends here, new life. And Christopher Walken, I mean, for God's sakes, Christopher Walken. That's right. It took me about 8 seconds while watching the two of them to go, hey, this has got to be the first time together since The Deer Hunter, 1978. What an incredible war film. Christopher Walken won an Oscar for it. Wow! Much different story here where Christopher Walken is teaching Robert De Niro all the fun little gimmicks he has, arcades he has at his place. They're acting like little kids. And of course, there is that big dodgeball game at Sky Zone. So listen, this is not the stuff of highfalutin entertainment, okay? But this is good family entertainment. Three of my boys who are 12, 9, and 4 were totally engaged, loved the movie, especially my elder two boys. Normally always take them to animated movies. They go, hey, this is the kind of live action movie we enjoy. It's funny. It's simple. I wouldn't say it's smart necessarily, but it's breezy. I laughed a couple of times. I think there's some amusing parts to it. And it's better than it has any reason that you expect it to be. So I'm giving it 2.5 Maple Leafs because I just enjoyed the experience of watching the film. Benjamin Lee of Guardian, the fact that the war with Grandpa finally dragged itself off from the shelf is something of a win, but now that we're able to see it, the real loser is us. The critics are going to scorch it. There's no doubt about it. But I enjoyed the war with Grandpa. Joe?
It's good. It sounds like it's good. It is what it is, and you're going there for the experience for the whole family. They have old people, they have middle-aged people, they have young people, but all those people would agree because it took the box office this weekend to gross $3.6 million, Adnan.
Wait, say that again? $3.6 million, that's it? Ugh.
Yeah, but Unseated Tenant in the process is the number one movie in America.
Wow. I mean, listen, these movie theaters are just taking a huge hit right now. It's just awful. God, it's frustrating to see, man. Ugh. Well, that was one of the things people were saying. They go, how is this movie actually still in theaters and not like streaming? But you know what? For people like me, we enjoyed it along with the other 3.6 million. Oh, it's tough, man. I swear to God, I drove by, like I said, my local theater here in Ridgewood. I'm like, anything I can do. I want to just go in there and give the manager $1,000. Seriously, keep this theater alive. I love movies. I'll sponsor it. Go ahead. We'll put a cinephile billboard out here, whatever it takes. Keep this thing going. Speaking of keeping things going, the good Lord Bird, one of my favorite actors, Ethan Hawke. God, he's brilliant. Take a listen to him on NPR, their latest podcast, which he spoke with the craft of acting. Very simply said, it's all about the work. If you put the work in, and with this character, he put a lot of work into it. John Brown, an abolitionist. The series is told from the point of view of Henry Shackelford, who's a fictional enslaved boy, part of John Brown's motley crew of abolitionist soldiers during the time of Bleeding Kansas, eventually participating in the famous 1850 raid on the Army Depot at Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. Brown's raid failed to initiate the slave revolt he intended, but was the instigating event that started the American Civil War. Co-creator, at least in this instance, is Ethan Hawke. He tells the story in NPR. He was working on The Magnificent Seven when Denzel Washington, the cinematographer, was reading the book about John Brown, which is based upon. And Ethan Hawke said, what are you reading? He goes, dude, you got to play this guy. You'd be great at playing John Brown. And clearly that cinematographer knew what he was talking about because Hawke is tremendous. And he fits the role so well because on the one hand, he really has a lot of relish in delivering these lines. Spittle flying out of his mouth, wide-eyed, crazy hair, big goatee, just in this feverish state of the fact that he's just desperate. He is so stubborn. He is so fiery about the fact he's going to free black people because this is unfair the way that they're being treated and that slavery is wrong. And he's consistently quoting scripture. I mean, it's amazing how well that Ethan Hawke dives into the verbiage of, you know, quoting Ecclesiastes and all the rest of it and applying it to modern life. And yet there's also some humor as well with the fact, particularly he goes in these very long sermons and they're all falling asleep. They're like, God, we're starving. He just keeps quoting scripture. At the same time, he's this incredibly violent person. One of the most shocking scenes in the first episode is he decapitates a guy. He gives this incredible speech about how this person has been harming black people and ruining Negroes, and this is your penance, this is your vengeance, here we go. And yet, it's not just a big screaming display of overacting. There's also some quiet moments of introspection, especially when he's talking to that character, Henry Shackelford, who very amusingly, he thinks he's a woman, because at one point when the father says Henria, he thinks he says Henrietta. So Ethan Hawke keeps thinking he's a woman. And so he takes on this young black boy. He's making him wear a dress. I mean, it's just incredibly awkward. He thinks it's Henrietta, but yes, it is Henry. And from Henry's point of view, he gets a real sense of what John Brown's about, especially some quieter moments around the campfire, you know, and you kind of get a sense of why this guy is so impassioned about what he's doing. I only saw the first episode. I don't have Showtime. Joe and I have already had one hashtag epic fail when it came to free previews, when it came to Apple Plus. So I don't know if I'm going to try that road again with Showtime. I think I already did the Showtime free preview, to be honest with you, because when I reviewed that Motown documentary, which I loved a few months ago, I definitely used a Showtime free preview to watch that. So I don't even know if I can do another one. But The Good Lord Bird, at least episode one, is fantastic. I'm giving it 4 Maple Leafs. If you're an Ethan Hawke fan like me, you'll love it. If you're interested in American history, you'll love it. If you think the whole issue of race relations in America goes back to what happened centuries ago, you'll also love it. If you're a fan of John Brown, the abolitionist, you wonder why he isn't studied more in history class, you'll love it as well. Matthew Gilbert of Boston Globe. The show's rowdy atmosphere is flexible enough to slide into intensely moving parts. Intensely moving and disturbing moments, thanks to directors such as Albert Hughes. That's right. That's the other part of this I wanted to mention. The Hughes brothers, right? Menace to Society. Albert Hughes is one of the directors. Also, Kevin Hooks and creator writers Hawk and Mark Richard, all of whom stay true to McBride's vision. And Ben Travers of IndieWire, with a rollicking pilot from director Albert Hughes, the limited series is bursting with lively music, well-staged shoutouts, and a wicked sense of humor. Holding it all together is Hawk. It's a masterclass. The Good Lord Bird on Showtime. Joe?
So, it sounds like Ethan Hawke, like in a lot of the movies, roles he takes on is the rug that holds this room together as far as the show goes. How's Daveed Diggs in it? Has he showed up in the first episode as Frederick Douglass yet?
Yeah, Frederick Douglass gets a cameo. Not a lot of screen time in the first episode, but I think he'll be good. There's a couple of funny lines, actually. They talk about Frederick Douglass, which is interesting. So, no, not a whole lot of him. If you like Boyhood like I did, Eller Coltrane is also in the film. You remember that name. He was, of course, a young boy featured in Richard Linklater's film. But we're going to do Mount Rushmore, Ethan Hawke, momentarily, just because I'm such a big fan of his and want to give him some love. One more movie, though, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, before we get to our special guest, Tug Coker, plus some entertainment news to pass along. Game show television producer Chuck Barris, Sam Rockwell, at the height of his career. His creation, The Dating Game, is one of the network's top shows, and he's just been given the post of hosting his latest brainchild, The Gong Show. What the public and industry bigwigs are unaware of is that Chuck Barris, game show pioneer, is also a covert assassin. He works for the CIA, claims to have killed 33 people. The greatness of George Clooney's directorial debut is you never know what's true and what isn't true. And I always love a story, a book, a piece of theater with an unreliable narrator because it's wacky and funny and strange, and you never can really trust your eyes. It's got great cameos, as you'd expect, with Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, Julia Roberts. Had no idea they were in the movie. But holding this one all together is the great Sam Rockwell. As I mentioned, this was his star turn, his coming out party, as it were, in terms of athletic talents. He's in virtually every scene of the movie. He's awfully charming. He's also sleazy. He's despicable, the way that he treats Drew Barrymore, his love interest, the fact that he's not faithful to her and isn't beholden to the fact that celibacy is an important thing. And yet, because it's Rockwell, and every character I think he ever plays, he imbues with a sense of humanity. And like I said, he's charming and reckless, even when he realizes what he's doing is just preposterous. He's literally hosting a game show. And by the way, those scenes are ridiculous. You don't trust any of those scenes. They're all made up. They have to be. There's one scene that the host asks the woman, what's the strangest location you've made love? And she goes, I don't know, in the ass. And this is like a black and white television. They all start laughing. Oh yeah, in the ass. So Clooney clearly is having a lot of fun. That's one of the real strengths, I think, when an actor becomes a director. Does he have a visual style? And clearly here, Clooney showed that he could do that. Very fluid camera. He's got dazzling sets, good production values, and especially the spy stuff. Like on the one hand, you've got Rockwell being this TV host, or at least TV pioneer. Again, Clooney's father, longtime newscaster. And at the same time, he's working for the CIA, and Clooney casts himself in that role. He is the guy who's giving him these assignments to go overseas, kill this Russian. He's a bad guy. More information you don't need to know. Just get it done. It's a very subversive story. Tim Robey of Daily Telegraph bounces around like the smarter and wilder older brother of Spielberg's Catch Me If You Can. And Sandra Hall of Sydney Morning Herald, directing for the first time, Clooney turns out to be a natural when it comes to parody. 3.5 Maple Leafs for Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. It came out 18 years ago. I happened to stumble upon it on HBO. I recommend it. Joe, not sure you've seen it.
I saw it years ago, and something I found out this morning, I thought this was a made-up story because Charlie Kaufman being the writer, I just chalked it up to, all right, this guy's a TV producer by day and a CIA agent by night, only to find out this morning that it was real. I had absolutely no idea. But would you compare this movie in a way to kind of like Autofocus, Paul Schrader, and Bob Crane of Hogan's Heroes and his double life that he had? How would you compare those two movies?
Well, I love that reference, Joe. Autofocus, I think, is an incredible film. I've talked about it a lot with Rogowski. I think it's a brilliant movie from Paul Schrader because Bob Crane is this guy, again, very likable personality, charming father next door, and then he's got this unbelievably sordid sex addiction, which is kind of pulling him underground. I mean, there's one great shot where he comes out of the pool and he's kind of assessing his life in slow motion, and Schrader said that was his homage to Apocalypse Now. I think Autofocus Focus is the much better film. I think it's one of those great underseen movies. Those who have seen it love it. By the way, once referenced on Curb Your Enthusiasm, when Jeff and Larry David get a Girls Gone Wild video, one of them says, this is like an autofocus moment. I was dying. I said, I don't know how many people actually get that joke, but that's an incredible joke. It's why those guys are so good improvising it. Autofocus, I thought, was it kind of went deeper and was more hard-hitting, especially when Bob Crane's descent, whereas here they kind of hint at Rockwell losing his mind a little bit as Chuck Barris. But it's a good point, Joe. They're kind of companion pieces in that likable TV personalities with very, very dark sides.
Right.
Let's do some entertainment news, then we'll get to Tug Coker. This is devastating news. I could not wait to see Pixar's Soul. It's supposed to be amazing. They're putting it now on Disney Plus. That's right. European cinema operators saying the move has shocked and dismayed them and deprived many audiences across the continent from watching the film. The decision on Soul is doubly frustrating for operators who were counting on the release after the film was previewed at a number of key European film festivals. Soul had its world premiere at the BFI London Film Festival on Saturday. It's going to play at the Rome Film Festival later this month. So it's going to be on Disney Plus in time for Christmas. It's going to launch on December 25th. Originally, it was supposed to be in theaters right around late November, so that's disappointing to hear. I mentioned Charlie Kaufman. I love him, the writer of Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, although he says he has a terrible relationship with George Clooney, so Clooney never consulted him, didn't talk to him, wanted to do things in a completely different manner, but we love Kaufman because of Ant Kind. He is an Oscar-winning screenwriter, and he is working on The Memory Police, new film. The Handmaid's Tale director Reed Morano and Kaufman are teaming up for this. Morano will direct and produce. Kaufman will write the script for The Memory Police, described as an Orwellian novel about the terrors of state surveillance. Cannot wait for that, because Charlie Kaufman's involved. That means I'm in. If you haven't seen it, check out I'm Thinking of Ending Things on Netflix. Tug Coker. He is here to talk about his very funny comedy series on the CW Network. Now We're Talking, plus Scott Rogowski and the Mount Rushmore of Ethan Hawke movies. Time to bring in our special guest here to Cinephile. Now We're Talking, the kind of show that's perfect for sports nuts and newbies alike. And our guest is Tug Coker. You can follow him at Tug Coker on Twitter and Instagram. It is the story of two ex-NFL quarterbacks and their quest to find post-career fulfillment in the ever-shifting world of sports media. Of course, being a sportscaster, it's something that I found very interesting and very funny. First season, 7 short-form episodes, 7 to 11 minutes in length, bundled into 3 episodes on CW Seed. Season 1 was a WGA nominee, and now season 2 of the Silly Series is back. Tug, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it, man.
Hey, the pleasure is mine. Love the podcast. I'm excited to be on the show. Thanks for having me on.
So I watched the first episode of season 1, and right away I'm laughing. Although, unfortunately, I should have realized, and I should make this clear to anybody with young children, because I was watching it just as I'm shoveling in some cereal, my kids are getting some homework done. There is an F-bomb used in the first few minutes, but it was very funny and used a very funny effect in which they're discussing about what's harder, you know, being a quarterback or being somebody who diffuses bombs. But I could already tell, like, I like the tone of it, and it's quick and it's witty. And I think those are the two things I want to focus on, Tug. Quick and witty, I think, in 2020 play a lot better than long and drawn out and thoughtful, which, as you know, is kind of the stuff that I like to enjoy. Oftentimes, you know, I just reviewed Never Rarely, Sometimes Always, this teen abortion drama, which wasn't to my taste, but that's the kind of indie movies that I'm going to watch. Your show is perfect, though, because it's great for today's generation. It's quick and it's witty. How key was that for you when you're putting it together, that, you know what, we're going to make sure time is of the essence and these jokes are going to land and it's not going to take 22 minutes?
Yeah, that's a great question. I listened to that episode last week, and I'm excited to see that movie. It couldn't be more different. Couldn't be more different than what we're dealing with. Now We're Talking, and I think Tommy Dewey and I. If you've seen some shows on Hulu like Casual or The Mindy Project, you've seen my partner in crime, Tommy Dewey, and it's just sort of like a window into how we interact. It's just a fun bantery sort of thing. And I think, you know, I love the fact that you guys just reviewed the Rushmore of buddy comedies, because we just wanted to have that sort of repartee that we see in some of the great buddy comedies. You know, it's like an antagonistic relationship where they also end up needing each other. And I think that's like sets up really well for, you know, comedy bantering off one each other, like a pairing of words. And so, yeah, I mean, as far as the quickness goes, I just feel like comedy, you know, if you know the construct of how things are made, and like everyone thinks comedy is louder, faster, funnier. Like, that's like the basic recipe. And we did not want to fall prey to that on the show.
100%. Talk to me about CWC, because this is the biggest thing. I often talk with friends in the business, and they say, it's never been better, it's never been worse. It's never been better because there's so many different areas that are starving for content. It's never been worse because it's so much harder to get your stuff seen, because it's not like we just have three networks back in the day and Family Ties is on at this time and The Cosby Show, et cetera. So tell me about CWC. Where can people find it? How did it come to be a smart recipe for you, in which a vehicle you wanted your show to be seen?
Yeah, well, you know, that's the interesting thing about the business. And you know this as well as I do. It's like, sometimes the creators have no control over where shows go. I mean, you know, Warner Brothers is our studio, and they really make a decision on where the shows go. And what happened was, we created this show back in 2016. Season one came out when Verizon was trying to get into the streaming game. And so Verizon started like a platform called Go90 that is eerily similar to what is happening in the, out there in the world today with a platform called Quibi, where they wanted to do like a digital. Are you familiar with Quibi?
I am. Quick Bites, Jeffrey Katzenberg. I know it's off to a bit of a rocky start, yeah, but I like the concept of it. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, exactly. So that's exactly right. So Go90 basically launched that as well. They tried to do like short form stuff, and they wanted to make stuff digital, mobile first, all these buzzwords that people like to use that we kind of satirized in the show. And what happened was, it went well. Season one got a Writers Guild nomination. We were really excited. They wanted to do season two. We said, let's do it, but only if we scale up to traditional half-hour length. They said, of course. And then the network shuttered. Like, it's one thing. There's so many pratfalls and obstacles to jump over in this business. You don't expect the network to implode. That's the one that you don't expect. And so when that did happen, we had to go out there and look for new partners. And, you know, as I mentioned to you off air, like, our partners are LeBron James's company, Uninterrupted, and Maverick Carter's next producer on the show. So we took it out to market. And what you see is, you know, just different ways of handling these things. Some platforms are interested in acquiring the project. Some don't want to do it because they feel like they want to have full hands on their project. They want it to be their baby. And so what happened with us is, we just found a nice symmetry with the CW, because of our relationship at Warner Brothers and the CW. And CW Seed. And so now you can find us anywhere you have Apple TV. It's free. It's on the Roku. It's on Amazon Fire. It's on a phone app. You have to sign up. Like, the only thing is, you don't have the foot traffic of being on Netflix or Hulu, but it is free. And we're sitting right next to Schitt's Creek. So it's really exciting for us to be up there with some of the prestige comedies. It's just, you just got to go do a little bit of looking on your, you know, apparatus.
I encourage everyone to go check it out. Like you said, find it on your apparatus. Tug Coker, at Tug Coker on Twitter and Instagram, our guest here in Cinephile. Like that great show, Brockmire, of course, I'm sure you love it. Hank Azaria is so funny. One of the keys there is not only that Hank loves baseball and translates that to the screen, but also is able to rely on some great cameos. Joe Buck, notably, is really funny on the show. Season two, as I see here, it's now 8 traditional half-hour episodes. This guest list is unbelievable. Having worked 9 years at ESPN, I know and really like Kerry Champion. Chris Broussard's a wonderful guy. Kurt Menefee, I don't know. Sean Merriman, Plexico Burress, Andrew Hawkins, Chris Rose. I know Menefee, obviously. I'm just saying I don't know him personally. Obviously, the host at Fox NFL Sunday. I'm actually filling in for Chris Rose today on MLB Network, his show Intentional Talk. Tell me about Rose's guest in particular, and I want to hear about Kerry and Brew.
Yeah, you know, it's so much fun to watch these athletes and broadcasters come be a little bit of fish out of water, because they still want to be good. Like, you still see their competitive nature carry over into the acting side. And so, you know, Kurt Menefee, I remember specifically, like, he was flying, when we shot his episodes, he was flying out to do, like, he was flying to Carolina to do, like, the Carolina Conference final game. So they moved up his plane because it was snowing. So, you know, luckily he came off book, as every athlete and every broadcaster did. I was so impressed with everyone coming to play. The funny thing about Broussard is that we logged off and created one day specifically for all these athletes and broadcasters to come on the show. And what you'll see with season two, so many things I feel like resonate with the media industry, and you're in it, so you know as well as I do, or at least I hope, all the things that we're trying to discuss, which is the rise and fall of the hot take environment, and how you know, these characters, my characters, you know, you got to name yourself. One rule about shows that you create, Mindy Kaling, you know, so on and so forth, you got to name yourself. So I named myself Tug Tanner in the show, and he's a fail. He was basically a first-round draft pick who didn't make it in the NFL. And he's like, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna become the best broadcaster. But he gets thrown into and swallowed into this hot take world, the hot take culture. And so what happens is we have all these broadcasters come on set to kind of battle him, and Broussard is a part of that. And what's amazing is there was no script. The entire thing was improvised. People were coming on the show and being like, what is this? And I'm like, just make fun of me, and I'm going to make fun of you. And that's it. And Broussard crushes it. So it's really fun to watch these people, these broadcasters, these athletes come in and show such dexterity. I mean, they're just basically live their life in front of the camera anyway. And so to watch people like Broussard, Terry Champion comes on, kicks off season two and basically does a recap for us. She's hilarious in it. Chris Rose is amazing. You'll see when you watch the episode, it takes place in a steam room where we're all in robes and talking about like the hierarchy of broadcasting, why he's at his place, why we're at our place. And it's just a lot of fun to watch these broadcasters and people that are on your TVs kind of let their hair down, so to speak, and to spend some jokes.
Rose simply texted back when I mentioned you. He said, I like Tug. I have zero acting skills, which is notable because as Tim Kirchin told me on Brockmire, he goes, you know, it's interesting. He goes, as broadcasters, there's certain skills we have that actors don't have. There's certain skills actors have that we don't have. Because, for example, and I'm not telling tales of the school here, Amanda Peet at one point, like they needed to like literally hold up a cue card with some of the sabermetrics that she had to spew just because she was so unfamiliar with whatever it was, right? UZR or defensive run saved or WOBA. I'm not sure what it was specifically. And he was like, oh, wow. Like as broadcasters, like I just know these stats and know this information. It's fine. He goes, having said that, in another sequence, Hank ripped off a monologue that he goes, it was like literally 3 minutes in length, and I couldn't even imagine the way he was able to memorize it, compartmentalize it, and then do different deliveries of it. He's like, when me, you know, I look at the information I'm about to present, I memorize a couple of statistics, I present the information, et cetera. So it is a good point. I think people often think, oh, well, you're broadcasters, you're on camera, you know how to do it. Well, no. Broadcasters, I look at the camera, I'm essentially playing myself, I'm just relaying information. With acting, it's a different persona. I'm obviously not looking at the camera. I have to rely more on the interplay with others. So I do think you're right in giving Chris and Carrie and Chris a credit for their acting skills, because it's not as easy a transition as some might think.
No, it's not an easy transition. And I will say one thing I love about Chris Rose is that we created a little blooper reel, and he does yell out, line! He's like, and he kind of does a quick aside and says, I've always wanted to say that. So you can kind of see, you can see the energy and excitement of being on the set and allowing everyone to come in and play. And one thing, you know, I listen to your show, and I know you guys review a lot of, you know, independent film, you know, older classics. And I think, like, one thing that we relate to as independent film is, you know, I think this is a kind of an underdog show. The people who love in the Venn diagram of sports and sports comedy will love the show. But one thing you have to appreciate is that, you know, we shot this like an indie film. We shot this in 22 days. You know, we were shooting this on the fly. You know, we're episodes of TV, you know, take 5 to 5 days for comedy or more. You know, we're shooting something 2 or 3 days. So it's incumbent on these broadcasters and athletes to come in and be on top of their game. And they, luckily they were, because otherwise we were going to be in real trouble.
No, that's a great point about the helter-skelter of it. You know, I'm with you. I love the indie movies because of their sensibilities and their attachment to telling stories that you wouldn't necessarily in multiplexes you'd see. The danger, as you said, is you don't have nearly as much money. And normally you want to, you know, take a page a day. You're shooting 3 or 4 pages a day, and it's just breakneck pacing. And kudos to you guys for pulling it off. Now we're talking, once again, as a show we're talking about. I want to talk about names. I always think it's so important in life, got a good name. Tug Coker is a great name because it's memorable and it's different. Years ago, my buddy Greg Found at ESPN, he used to always tell me, you want to have a name that's 3 syllables and the first name is different. So he said, Reese Davis is a great name because it's 3 syllables and Reese is not a name that a lot of guys have, and maybe that's helped Reese Davis's career. Tom Brokaw. Tom is a familiar name, but again, 3 syllables. Tom Brokaw. It's very quick. Now he said, Adnan Virk is good because it's 3 syllables. But your first name's a little tough. People aren't sure. Is it Adam? Is it Adrian? They get a little tripped up. So Tug Coker, I think, is a perfect name because it is 3 syllables and no one's going to mess up Tug and no one's going to forget Tug. Is this your real name or is this a handle you've given yourself?
Well, I appreciate it. It's not a handle I give myself. It's a handle my parents gave to me. I've had it since I was 1 day old, and you're a baseball man, so they named me after Tug McGraw.
Tug McGraw.
Yeah. So everyone says, you know, as we move along in life, and then people are less familiar with Tug McGraw, and I always say, do you know who Tim McGraw is? And they say, of course, yes. And I say, well, that's his dad. I was named after Tim McGraw's dad, Tug McGraw, and my dad played baseball at Oklahoma. You know, I've always loved sports, and I think I, you know, told you off air, like my acting career has been kind of circled around so much of sports. You know, years ago I did a Broadway show where I played Larry Bird, and you know, and I told you the director of that show was Tommy Cale, whose next show was Hamilton. So he basically quickly eschewed me to the side and said, let me go and work on this classic that will change the history of the Broadway musical. But yeah, I agree with you. I think names are so important, and I have been very lucky to have Tug Coker. Everyone does remember it. And I wanted to pull that into the show. And it's funny, three syllables does sound good when you say it, because I named my character Tug Tanner. And I just felt like that rolled off the tongue in a fun way. So, yeah, I mean, you and I are the three-syllable team.
Before I let you go, Tug, tell me about playing Larry Bird. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that. I was looking at the notes here. That's incredible that you did that. The hick from French Lick, I'm sure you dived into research and information. And obviously, we just saw LeBron win another title. But for so many, the 80s basketball Magic Bird rivalry is iconic. How did you even approach a role like that?
I was scared. I mean, I was very intimidated because I loved Larry Bird growing up. He was my favorite player. I'm a Boston Celtics fan. And so, you know, I just did all, basically like you, any other actor that you talk to on the show, like I just dove into the work and I just tried to, you know, we worked in a relationship with the NBA and I was able to drive cross country and go to French Lick. I went to Terre Haute where Indiana State is. You know, I got to meet Larry several times. You know, both Larry and Magic came to opening night, which was amazing because I had to shoot baskets in the show. And so, here I am, like, I played basketball for 1 year. I never played, actually, at the College of William & Mary, D1 school, right, where it was basically a red shirt. And I always wanted to play basketball, but the irony is now I played basketball for Larry and Magic on a Broadway stage shooting baskets. And the funny thing about opening night was, is that, like, no one was watching me. Everyone was watching Magic and Larry in the audience, like, to see if they were enjoying the show. So that was like the one of the craziest nights to perform that I've ever experienced, because it was like, you know, playing for the king. But you know, that I will say that show, it is part of the reason why Now We're Talking was born, because so many of the things that we're talking about in season two of Now We're Talking, I feel like resonate in the media, sports media culture. And one of the reasons I talk about Magic Bird is because Magic and Larry were producers on the show, and so they were able to control some of the storytelling, and I felt like that was an interesting idea, and we play with that in a season two where my character wants to change the narrative. These are all these words that I know you use and the sports media culture uses: change the narrative, change the culture. So this Tug Coker tries to change the narrative by creating his own documentary, which we've now seen happen with The Last Dance and Michael Jordan. You see Tom Brady. And now I think we've started a whole culture where every athlete's going to want to control their own narrative post-career by making their own, you know, biographies. So it's that's part of the fun for me with this show, is kind of skewering what I think is happening in the sports media world. So it's my whole career seems to be a part of that.
You're right about control the narrative. I was about to say later today on air that Clayton Kershaw, this is going to change the narrative of his career with the start. I just see breaking news. He's scratched from a start with back spasms. So, again, his narrative is changing again. In a critical start for the LA Dodgers, he's not even pitching. I cannot wait to watch the rest of Now We're Talking. Once again, everybody check it out. Season 1, Season 2, CWC. Tug Coker is his name. Go to Instagram. Go to Twitter. You can follow him, TugCoker. Thanks for reaching out, Tug. First and foremost, thanks for reaching out and letting me know, hey, here's what I'm doing. You might be into this, because I'm totally into it. And it was a blast. And I appreciate talking to you. And congrats on the show. And all the best, man.
All right, same to you. Like, as I said, I'm a fan of the show. I really think Now We're Talking deserves 4 Maple Leafs. So everyone go out there, you know, check out my Instagram and my Twitter. I do a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff. And we show a lot of, you know, aspiring filmmakers and actors, like how we made the show. So I think if you're into something that's interesting to you, I hope you'll check out my Instagram.
I'll take a cameo for season 3. I'm following you on Instagram and Twitter right now. Thanks so much, Doug.
You're in. I really appreciate the time.
Get ready, guys and gals. It's time for Ragtime with Scott Rogowski.
Rags Time is back in full effect. Our boy Scott Rogowski always does a great job giving us his favorite picks of the week. Now, Rags, I see you right now wearing a bathrobe, and as you just told me, it's been a long week, some sleepless nights. I feel for you. You doing okay?
It's been a long, long time. Dun, dun, dun. I ought to praise you like I should. What's that? I don't know.
Fat Boy Slim, praise you, yeah.
Exactly, which is the opening song to Michael Winterbottom's Greed.
Oh, yeah. So you're really on this kick with your boy there.
Starring Steve Coogan, as mentioned last week. Isla Fisher? Island Fisher? Isla, however you want to call it.
She was in Wedding Crashers, Vince Vaughn's love interest.
Mrs. Borat?
Yes.
I do want to credit, I have to credit one of your listeners, and I'll call them your listeners because, look, they're your listeners, not my listeners.
No, they're listeners to Ragtime. Go ahead.
It is Mr. Norm. The G is silent. At Norm44 on Twitter, who wrote to us, "Hey guys, there are a rare few that appreciate Steve Coogan. He's brilliant. Love the Trip films, 24-hour party people. Maybe you could review this gem from Steve and Michael Winterbottom that came out this year." And that's exactly what I'm prepared to do today, except caveat, I'm prepared to review the first 58 minutes of Greed. 58 minutes of a total runtime closer to 2 hours, I believe, because I just turned it on this morning and I have not finished it. So I'm literally in the middle of it. It's starting to take the turn from ha-ha, you know, fluffy satire to, ooh, there's some actual seriousness at the heart of this thing, and we're talking about real world problems in the high street fashion industry, which of course you could extrapolate to most all capitalism in the Western Hemisphere, and the exploitation of Asian markets as as Adnan, you know all too well, yourself being exploited by the Western cabal.
I'm okay being Canadian, but yeah, South Asian forces have been definitely exploited. My generations prior absolutely have definitely faced some issues. Yes.
I love I just throw you in there with Sri Lankan sweatshop workers. But isn't that how you feel sometimes, MLB Network? And then I caught you yesterday hosting MLB Tonight with Leiter and Floyd, Al Leiter, Cliff Floyd. And I got to say, for as much as I miss hanging out with you, hanging out with those guys, just being around the office, all the people there, I got to say, it is nice not having to come up with my take on Kenley Jansen's cutter.
Well, the biggest thing, as you know, is you got to fill the time, right? It's a 2-hour show. So in the past, you never do a 3-hour show. And it's like, to your point, sometimes you just have like 15 seconds worth of material. It's like a comedian. I've got 30 seconds worth of jokes and I'm good. No, you got to fill the time. You got to fill 10 minutes. So with a 2-hour show, you got to go. Yeah.
For example, if I were at MLB Network today, I'd say, Amy Coney Barrett, is she related to Michael Barrett? And if so, I'd like to ask her, how would she handle a left hook from A.J. Pierzynski?
Okay, if you want to go into politics, how much of this are you watching? You watching these hearings, this new potential Supreme Court justice here, Ms. Barrett?
Honestly, my entire take on it would just to make jokes about A.J. Pierzynski. Sorry, I got a phone call there. That actually was Michael Barrett's agent. He's furious. He overheard me.
Former Expos catcher, yes.
Maybe that was Lindsey Graham, actually. Maybe that was asking for...
Lindsey Graham in a big race right now. That's a lot of pressure.
Lindsey Moonlight Graham.
Yes. I love Field of Dreams references.
See, that's what I'd be doing, Adnan. If we were on the change-up tonight, I would just take all of the Senate confirmation hearing characters and turn them into baseball players, and then we'd have our own little skit and sketch.
Well, that's always the key. Listen, but with your former career, HQ Trivia, you're always known for having great nicknames. So it would just be an extension. It would just be utilizing more politics and current events and such.
Yeah. How about Amy COVID Barrett? Hello.
Oh, jeez.
AKA Supreme Court Super Spreader. Look, I know
simple crash.
I've had a rough week. I'm not sleeping much. I've got a lot cooking in my other career here. You know, I'm more than just a part-time segment on a Cinephile podcast.
Well, yeah. By the way, can you give us any more insight? You were talking about developing material specifically for a phone.
Yeah. Can I give you any more insight? Well, should I unpeel this onion slowly week by week? Let me just say this. Let me put this idea into your head and your listeners' head. You know, you're a television star.
I wouldn't go that far, but thanks.
You've made your bones in the TV business. Mm-hmm. We can say that. And now, where do you see the TV business in the next 10, 20, 30 years?
Well, I think it's a situation we have to consistently adapt. I mean, again, to make it about movies, the great Pat Ishevsky with Network, you know, he forecast the future. He forecast the rise of cable news, all the hand-wringing, all the rhetoric right now. Sidney Lumet, are one of our favorites, expertly directed. I think that people will just use other mediums in which to consume media. So maybe they will not watch television as much, the nightly news, as you and I have discussed, but they'll watch it on their phone. They'll watch it on, you know, iPads and those kinds of means.
You see, for you and fans of movies like your listeners, I believe movies will forever be safe. They're never going to come for our film because you can't recreate them. I mean, look at Quibi trying to put movies on the phone. And I mean, you can watch Netflix on your phone and you know what? God bless you. It's not meant for it. Movies are meant for the biggest screens, right? You're sacrificing the screens for convenience when you're watching stuff on your phone. And as this pandemic has proven, with Quibi launching in April in the middle of the pandemic, you know, meant to be for the on-the-go consumer, the commuter, when there is no on-the-go, when there is no commuting, it's just convenient to sit at home and watch in your home theater on your big screen, right? I mean, obviously, you want to watch the new Scorsese movie on the big screen, not on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
So the movies will be safe, and the premium TV, your Showtime, your HBO, your Game of Thrones, all that, because those are essentially, let's be honest, those are just long movies split into hour-long chapters.
Right.
So that's where I believe you know those are those are defensible. However, your TV career may not be, and I say that because yes, as you alluded to. You know, your career, let me put it this way. And here's the bigger point. Where will the Adnan Verks go? Where will the all these reality show stars and game show hosts, the Alex Trebeks of the future, Pat Sajak, are they just going to, I mean, those are a little older, but the younger, the Chris Hardwick, there's a better example. Let's say Chris Hardwick. What's Chris Hardwick going to do when people stop watching TV? Is he just going to retire? Is he going to move under a bridge somewhere? And because he's broke and unemployed? No. All the producers, all the writers, all the talent on TV will find homes elsewhere. Although they'll find ways to adapt. But where is that home going to be? Is it going to be on YouTube, on Twitch, on TikTok, on Instagram Live, on Facebook? Where do you think it's going to be?
One of those mediums, right? Like it's going to be some, I don't think it's going to be something we've never heard of, right? Because TikTok, it's relatively new. So it'll be some new medium or new social media, I should say, that we don't even know yet.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I'm building.
Oh, yes. I like it. See, that's bringing it
forward. I'll leave it at that.
I love it. Leave it at that.
Getting back to Steve Coogan and Michael Winterbaum so that Norm with a G doesn't say, what the hell happened to the review? Went totally off the rails. I would say, Norm, you're correct. And I would also say, I'm not finished with it, but I like what I'm watching so far. You know, Steve Coogan, as I talked about, is just one of the unmatched, unparalleled geniuses of our generation. And by the way, I didn't even mention this last time. Have you seen Philomena?
Yeah, I've seen actually a rare dramatic role from him and Judi Dench. Excellent film.
That's
was nominated
right.
Best Picture, did very well at the Oscars. He wasn't nominated, but I think Dench was nominated. I think it was nominated for Best Picture as well.
Yes, and he was a co-writer on the film, and he basically discovered this story and adapted it. So, I mean, Coogan can do it all as far as I can
tell.
Yeah,
I mean, rare dramatic role. Remember, he's like a big atheist, and Judi Dench is a very religious character, Catholic. I thought their conversations were very realistic, true to life. I agree with you. Coogan showed some reach there with Philomena.
Right. And by the way, have you seen Dame Judi when she was a younger woman?
I haven't, actually. I always feel like I've known Dame Judi Dench from like 98 on, Shakespeare in Love on. It's kind of like Helen Mirren. I couldn't imagine them like as young debutantes.
Yeah. Well, let's just say she was more like Dame Judi drenched.
Jeez. I can only imagine some of the videos and pictures you've seen. You can follow us.
Here's a more safe for work version of that. Hey, I saw Dame Judi caught in a rainstorm the other night. Talk about Dame Judi drenched.
heavy rain right now in the Tri-State area. So you know what? That'll work. That'll absolutely work. Judy Dench in a rainstorm. What do you call her? Perfect joke back, for the kids.
Back to green. Back to green. So my point is Coogan could do the comedic and the dramatic. And this movie sort of blends the two because here he is, the loudmouth, the brash, the greedy, you know, a retail magnate who is exploiting workers around the world, who is dodging taxes, who is pulling Trump tactics, you know, sleight of hand. He's a magician. And it's all a chicanery and a charade and a chimera. Isn't that the Greek word? Or the chimera?
I'm not 100% aware of that. It's a good word, though, yeah.
So speaking of, this movie takes place in Greece, part of it, Mykonos and Monaco. I think Winterbottom made this movie just so we can travel to these exotic locations and hang out on yachts, because that's what they're mostly doing.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's some great lines. I mean, Coogan's got the way with words, man. There's a great line when he flashes back. You know, so the main drive of the narrative is David Mitchell from that Mitchell and Webb look. Do you know him? A British actor.
I don't know.
Very funny as well. You know, his role is okay in this one. It kind of plays this. The jokes kind of get old. He's kind of a timid, you know, dorky reporter. But that Mitchell and Webb look, to recommend another British comedy, I'm sure if you've known Coogan, you know that show. Anyway. David Mitchell's writing this biography about him, and it's flashing back to his younger days. And there's a scene when he's in you know, school, this like fancy private school in England, and you know his headmaster says like, "Hey, come on, MacReady, it's your turn." And he goes, "I can't." And then the headmaster goes, "There is no can't." He's like, "That's not true. That's what we all call you. Well, at least a word that sounds like it."
Perfect. All right. Good tease for next week. At Scott Rogowski, Twitter and Instagram. More on greed, and we'll continue our love fest with Steve Coogan. Get some sleep, my man. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, I'm stirring the sauce. Bye.
Mount Rushmore.
While the Mount Rushmore Ethan Hawke movies, listen, I think this guy is such a versatile, talented actor. You know, he burst on the scene. You see him in Dead Poets Society, just a young man. I think he was 18 years old back in 1989. He became a symbol for Gen X with what he was able to do with Reality Bites, his great love interest with Winona Ryder and Ben Stiller. And then from there, I think a lot of people, you know, as he said on the NPR podcast, people know him for different things. He's a science fiction fan. They know him for stuff like Gattaca. He said there's definitely the Linklater fans that know him for the Before Sunrise trilogy. And he said, you know, there's obviously the movie, you know, more mainstream people, they like him for Training Day, Oscar nominated, great performance alongside Denzel. And he said, and then there's some people who really love First Reformed. I'm like, yes, I'm so glad he said the First Reformed people, because that would be me. I think that's the best performance of his career, an incredible Paul Schrader film. Schrader, for the first time ever in his life, was nominated for Best Original Screenplay. Hawke was cruelly ignored, should have been nominated for Best Actor. He's never been nominated for Best Actor. He's been nominated twice for Best Supporting Actor. He's been nominated twice for Best Original Screenplay, writing those scripts with Linklater. But it's a shame that First Reform was not nominated. It's a brilliant, brilliant film. It was one of my favorite movies of this decade. I also love a movie called The Phenom. Again, nobody saw this movie. I mentioned it to him. I met Ethan Hawke a few years ago. I mentioned it to him at Sundance. I go, man, I thought The Phenom was terrific. He plays this abusive father. He's kind of like De Niro in This Boy's Life. And the kid is a star baseball pitcher. Paul Giamatti plays a psychiatrist. And he was like, yeah. He's a great guy, Ethan Hawke. Very engaging. He said, oh, yeah, man. He goes, I love that movie. I wish more people had seen it. I'm glad you saw it. I'm glad you liked it. I'm like, oh, yeah, I thought it was terrific. If you haven't seen The Phenom, look it up. Like I said, playing an abusive father, he's excellent. First Reformed is tremendous. Those are two that I've got to get in there. Then it gets tricky because I want to mention Juliet Naked. It's a small role, but I did think he was compelling in the movie. It doesn't get nearly enough love, but I'm not going to go with that. Born to be Blue, since I like jazz, I thought he was tremendous playing Chet Baker. It's an incredible performance. There's one scene where he's talking about drug addiction, and he says, you know, when I'm on heroin, I can get inside every note. I can really feel it. And the look on his face, the way he's just cringing at despair, he realizes this addiction will absolutely ruin him, yet he's powerless to stop it. It's one of the best moments of screen acting I've ever seen from him. Born to be Blue is an incredible movie. And lastly, I will go with Boyhood. He was nominated Best Supporting Actor in that movie. Again, playing a father whose heart is in the right place, but oftentimes by his actions is not being the best possible role model for his kid. That's number four for me. I think it's a really special movie, and obviously took Linklater years and years to do, and I admire their endurance in doing so. Boyhood, Born to be Blue, First Reformed, and The Phenom. That's not movies you'd often think of when you see the name Ethan Hawke. You're normally thinking of Training Day and, you know, Waking Life. Who knows? Other movies like that. But that's my list, and I'm sticking to it. Joe?
Okay, I'm going to back you up on Boyhood, just how they were able to pull that movie off. They filmed it over 12 years. I'm also going to go with, you know, right before he came out with Magnificent Seven, he came out with a different Western called In a Valley of Violence.
It yes.
Him, John Travolta. It is, I think it's great. He has a dog in it. It's fantastic, but I thought it got overshadowed by Magnificent Seven when that came out. So I'll put that on my list too. Oh boy, I guess I will put on Training Day. I will put on Training Day. And then the last one's tough. First off, I'll give my honorable mention to Gattaca, 1997. And then I will back you up on Born to Be Blue. Chet Baker's my favorite jazz artist of all time. I thought that movie really captured his comeback in the late 60s when he was in his 30s. And Ethan Hawke kills them in that. So my four are Born to Be Blue, Training Day, Boyhood, and In a Valley of Violence.
I love the shit up for In a Valley of Violence. I also really like that movie. Joey Galloway thought it was crazy, thought it was too slow, but I thought that was an underrated Western. Again, if you look at Ethan Hawke's career, it's amazing how many different genres he hits. He's a guy, again, we did not mention Dead Poets Society. A lot of people remember him in that role, Robert Sean Leonard as well, but he takes a lot of chances. And by the way, honorable mention, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, the final film from Sidney Lumet, one of my favorite directors. I love the chemistry with him and Philip Seymour Hoffman as that crime, that Jewel Heist goes unraveled. Incredible stuff. I wish could have squeezed it on there, but you know what? It's only Mount Rushmore. That's why it's four movies. Thank you so much for checking us out. As always, here on Cinephile, The Trial of Chicago 7, Aaron Sorkin's new film, is coming out on Netflix this Friday. I'll be reviewing that next week on Cinephile. My thanks to Scott Rogowski, as always. My thanks to my great producer, Joe Engelbrecht. And thank you to Tug Coker as well. And thank you to all of you. Please do tweet me, CinephilePod, or at Adnan Esferk, or go to Apple Podcasts. You can subscribe, rate, and review. You guys are the best. I'll see you at the movies.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.